Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable.
We're leaving today and entering a world of Mickey Mouse waving, princess meeting and greeting, lightsaber clashing, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror dropping, Banshee flying, Space Mountain launching, galaxy rewinding, what is the point of galaxy rewinding, fireworks igniting, world of other worlds, for whatever you love. Infinite worlds await at the most magical place on Earth, Walt Disney World Resort.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
You saw the game-winning play once, but have to replay it 3 times on the way back to the hotel. Because some moments don't end at the buzzer. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
Hey everybody, I just wanted to make a quick disclaimer before you get into this episode. I did this podcast on location, and my recording device that I brought had a little bit of a malfunction. The malfunction was I forgot to press the button, but about 4 minutes into this episode, I remembered and pressed the button. So there will be a quality jump at about 4 minutes, but the audio before that is not necessarily the worst. It's just not quite as good as you're probably used to with this podcast, but it is still totally listenable. But anyways, I just wanted to let you guys know that.
Welcome to the How to Hunt Turkey podcast. I'm your host, Jay Screer. With me, I have 2 guests today, so that's twice as many guests as normal. I've got Nathaniel Maddox, who's been on the podcast before, and a new guest today. This is Connor Mobley.
Yep.
So I was trying to add more to it. Again, we just talked about
it. You got it.
I immediately forgot it. But anyways, a couple of turkey hunters, a couple of turkey killers, and man, guys, thanks for being on the show today. I appreciate it. It's always good to get to come be in the flesh and blood with people, like in person. It's extra exciting that way. So So it's mid-March. Turkey season is too far away, I think. But what do you guys think this time of year? Like, Connor, we'll start with you. What's your headspace? Are you just chomping at the bit or what?
Yeah, well, always. yeah, those first few days, those first few warm days, actually, normally they happen in like February, right? And you're like, all right, they've got to be out. They've got to be gobbling. I got to go listen. But the first few times I go listen, yeah, they're still in their winter patterns and whatnot and all that. But yeah, I get ready pretty quick. And then we always have that next cold snap like it did, I think, a couple weeks ago where it got real cold and whatever and all that. But yeah, now I think we're going to stay pretty warm. And as of now, they are gobbling pretty good. You can see them strutting in the fields and stuff. And
yeah,
it gets me really excited. And it's almost too early every year. And our season got pushed back a little bit this year. So
yeah, it did.
Now I think about it right now, it's like warm and I want to go hunt, and season's technically over a month away in Missouri.
Yeah.
So, and I see how green it's going to get, and it's going to be really green by the time season gets here.
Absolutely.
So that's going to be different, but, yeah, I'm excited as always.
I was thinking yesterday, I thought, man, if I could legally go tomorrow morning, I would.
Yeah.
And there are some Ozarkians who will anyways. We're going to talk about that. So what about you, Nathaniel? What are you thinking about?
We've usually already seen some turkeys killed by the middle of March. This is a unique year. We're not traveling and filming anything right now, really. So not for the next couple of weeks. So it's a little bit strange. I don't think too many years have gone by where we haven't been to South Texas or Florida with an early March turkey season. I've been seeing birds moving. They were strutting a little bit Sunday by the house. I yelped at a group of 35, and seven of them decided to go and strut all at the same time for about 2 seconds.
Hey, that'll
enough to get me excited, though.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
So we're working on growing and retaining our turkey population on our farm. So we're not mad enough to want to kill them all this year. I think we're going to try to do what we've done the last 4 or 5 years and maybe pull a couple out, but try to see if we can get our flocks back up to a good size.
Yeah. Are you going to try and supplement that with hunting other places or going on trips or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my son and I, Maverick, he finished his grand slam last year. So yeah, it's really cool. He's 10 now. And so we have a deal where we're going to do a road trip every year and go to another state. So we're going to go to Tennessee sometime here. I guess it's opening day of Missouri season. We'll be in Tennessee.
Okay.
With my buddy, Hunter Pruitt, and he's got us some birds lined up.
Nice.
He runs a thing called the National Wildlife Co-op. It's a cool organization. And anyway, going to go to Middle Tennessee, and then going to go to Wyoming, to our Wyoming spot, Connor and I and a couple of our clients. I think that's it, Tennessee and Wyoming. So it's going to be a good, fun time. And then a lot of Missouri hunting. We'll definitely hunt a lot of properties around here. There's a lot of opportunities.
Yeah, lots of opportunities for sure. That's super cool. So as we get into it, and now that birds are starting to gobble, like Connor, do you go to a lot of different properties, or do you kind of hunt the same spot? What's your sort of approach like before the season starts, scouting wise?
A lot of different spots. We don't hunt. Most properties we hunt they're pretty much one bird property. So there might be multiple birds in a group there, but you kill a bird there, you're good. We're going to go kill one somewhere else. We do, being here in Lebanon, east of us, we have a ton of Mark Twain National Forest. So tons of great turkey hunting out there. You have to walk past four Cajuns and some people from Mississippi every time you go hunting, but it's okay. You can find a turkey if you want to. So that's always an opportunity out there. And being that Missouri's new all day rule, public land is still only till one. After that, you can hunt private. So if you want to, you can kind of tier it out. You can hunt Bruce birds in the morning on public, and then go hunt your private spots in the afternoon.
Yeah.
So we'll start scouting a lot of different places. I I run game cameras for turkeys still. It's not just a deer thing. I'll do turkeys as well. That's always fun to see it. I'm just as glued to my cell cams right now as I am in, late October. So, they're not as exciting as deer. They all look kind of the same on pictures, but, they're still there. They'll start strutting. They're strutting right now. I mean, every morning, I've got one of my places, they'll fly down and they're strutting in front of the camera out there in the field and stuff. So that's always good. And you just get out before work and listen for them to gobble.
Yeah.
And that's a good way to find them as well. And, that's about it. But yeah, as far as different spots, we've got plenty of spots. I've got a good group of core friends that have plenty of turkey spots as well. And,
oh, nice.
So we kind of take turns and go back and forth and, hey, let's go hunt that place today. Let's go hunt that place. And we killed the bird here. Let's go over here. We can kind of share birds and stuff.
That's cool.
It's a little different than deer. It's kind of like, oh, this is my spot, but we haven't killed one yet. You got a tag, you can go kill it or whatever. It's more of a more fun and laxed.
Very different than deer. I don't know if anybody who's like, hey, you haven't killed your buck yet. Come on out to my place.
No, that doesn't happen at all. It doesn't happen at all.
Every year I think I'm going to be that guy. And then I'm like, if I ever see you anywhere near my property.
Yeah, exactly.
So they go. So when you're running cameras for turkeys, how do you go about that? I mean, not a lot of people do that. What's your approach? How do you find success doing that?
Yeah. It's basically trial and error and finding their strut zones is how you do it, so that's basically it.
Just go throw a camera up till you see turkeys.
Basically, yeah. Go put your camera out. And a lot of that is also after it's either land I've hunted before, so I know they're there. So basically it's just getting a count for the year. Or it's land where I've heard one in the area. Mm-hmm. Turkeys are very much going to walk roads, and they're somewhat predictable. So you can put cameras on roads and logging roads and corners of fields and whatnot. You can find them somewhat quick, I'd say, using cameras. And it's just fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I always love running cameras because it's like a catch and release trap line. I always feel like, ha, caught one.
Yeah.
But it's still out there doing its thing for sure. Yeah, that's cool. So, Nathaniel, you might have mentioned this a minute ago, but what's your first trip this year going to be turkey hunting?
So, great question. I guess our first trip will be the Tennessee trip, me and Maverick, my son. Actually, I do have I forgot about this when you asked me a few minutes ago, but my buddy Nathan Webb, who Nathan and I went to C of O together, and he taught me so much about turkey hunting. And I grew up deer hunting primarily. My parents don't hunt. My grandparents don't hunt. So I kind of figured it all out. And then somewhere in junior high, I realized that there was turkeys everywhere, and I got to figure out how to kill them. And I kind of taught myself a little bit. I watched a lot of Mossy Oak videos and Night and Hail videos and learned some tips. But when I got to college, my buddy Nathan Webb, man, he just like was so good at turkey hunting. And so he taught me a lot. And that was when I first picked up a camera. I started filming him. So we would go film. And it's funny because this morning, actually, I've been digitizing my whole collection of footage from all my tapes. And I'm almost done with it. But this morning, Connor and I were looking at some of my turkey hunts from 2004, me and Webb. And anyway, he and I have not hunted together. He left college in 2006 to go get his PhD. He lives in Nashville now, and he's a doctor at Vanderbilt. And so anyway, we got a long story short, a hunt plan this year.
Oh, nice.
And we haven't hunted together in 20 years. So I'm really stoked about that, just to reconnect with an old friend. And so there was like a little small circle of us in that time period, early 2000s, who were in college, me and him and my buddy Brandon Pendergrass and Jeff Lovin. And they're all best friends from Willow Springs, Missouri. And I got kind of pulled into their friend group. So all those guys have taught me a lot about turkey hunting. And we still work with Pender and Jeff now. We've been working with them for a long time through Hayden Outdoors, the TV show that we produce. So that wasn't your exact question, but I'm looking forward to my hunt with Webb. Yeah. I hope we get some good laughs and reminisce and kill some turkeys. So
I would bet so. You know, there's something about making friends and making memories outside. They last a little bit different. you know, than a lot of other ones do. I know for sure, like, I never laugh as much as I do when I'm hanging out with my hunting and fishing buddies and you're out somewhere just absolutely goofing off the way that only, like, nature can give you, right? So I think that's cool, man, just to have that to look forward to. So when you're going on this hunt, how do you foresee the dynamic playing out? Like, when you would hunt with him back in the day, was he doing more of the calling? Were you doing more? Are you better than him now? Huh. Has he gotten worse? What do you think it's going to be?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I definitely probably hunt more because it's part of my job. And he's working at the college in Nashville, so mm-hmm. probably gets a couple of windows every year to go out. I don't know. I'd say we'll probably just run around my farm, and usually if we kill a turkey, we kill a turkey. You know, that's kind of the hunts I am usually on with my old buddies. So I bet we'll have fun chasing birds on the farm. And like I said earlier, we don't get too serious about it. We're really serious about enjoying the birds and watching them and having them in our yard all winter and seeing the poults in the spring. So killing them has become less of a priority, but it's funny that killing them has become less of a priority, but getting out is still just as much of a priority.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's just, I don't know. It's about seeing the birds and enjoying mm-hmm. them. And I've got such nostalgic memories of the early 2000s, late 90s, that era where there were so many birds on our farm. And, I really, really want to see that the case again.
Yeah.
You know? And so if that means, you know, taking it easy, that's 100% fine by me.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Kids and nieces and nephews that all need to grow up hunting them. So.
Yeah. Well, it's like we were just talking about before I hit record about how your perspective of what a good day is changes depending on your approach. And so, like, for yourself to come of age turkey hunting in the boom years and just to stack them up for years. Now, the cool thing about the vastness of the outdoors is there's something for any way you want to come at the sport, whether as a habitat manager, as a photographer, as a videographer, or as someone who wants to just eat every turkey he's ever seen or mount every feather. You know, like, there are those people who do those mounts with every single feather of the turkey, and it stresses me out to even think about it. But how cool would that be? And so there's always something to pursue, right? Whereas I think, like, I don't know where I'm at. I've only been turkey hunting for a few years. But I can see a world in which I appreciate them more than I feel the need to hunt them, right? Like, and it's not that I appreciate them any less now. It's just that I appreciate a different part of it. And there's always a different part to appreciate. And I think that as I go, I'll get to that point. It's like it's happened to me with bow fishing in the last few years. First few trips out, I was like, any fish that's legal, plus some. I'm just gonna, no, not plus some, but I'm just, gonna shoot any legal fish I see. And then, like, we went out, I don't know, a week ago because it was a nice warm day and it's not turkey season yet. And we got out there and we shot a handful of fish and they were good fish. And I was like, okay, I don't really need to do that again for a while. And it just changes, you know, like you go for that other thing and there's always some other way. And, you know, whether that's to, I'm going to stop using decoys or whatever. Right. And I'm still on the, like, if you can kill a turkey at all, thank goodness. Like, yeah, I'm still such a novice. Right. So, but what about you, Connor? Where do you feel like you're at in that sort of journey? Are you about ready to hang up your shotgun and pick up a camera or no?
Oh, I've kind of been that way for a long time.
Your whole life?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, I love to shoot a turkey. I love to shoot a turkey and, you know, it's fun. But the creative side of me and just the seeing other people enjoy it is just awesome. Like, you can't, after you've shot so many turkeys, they're all different, but it's all kind of like, yeah, shot another turkey, you know, great. But seeing other people do it, your buddies or whatever, seeing how excited they get and all that is awesome. And on my side, getting to capture that, just selfishly getting great footage of the bird and telling a great story and all that is just, it adds up to, I don't have to be behind the gun near as much as I once thought I did, you know. We all go through those stages where you want to shoot every turkey ever, and you see it, and you're like, oh, yeah. How do I get to it, and all that.
Yeah.
But it's just not that way anymore. Sure. Also related to, I'm old enough now, and I recognize that there is a population problem. I don't know if you sure. that's the right words, but we'll use that word. So you once you've hunted enough, at least for me, I'm 26, but once you've done it enough, you're like, oh wait, there's a possibility this won't be here forever.
Yeah.
Or this could not be here forever.
Right.
And it's like, oh, now we got to step it up this generation to make sure it is
yeah.
forever for us to enjoy and for the next generations to enjoy. So that comes with, I would much rather watch a group of strutters out in the field all day than
yeah.
be like, how do I go kill those? I want to kill yeah. every one of them. So, that's where that's at. And, you know, I feel like I hear this every year, but, especially this time of year, but people are saying they're seeing more turkeys this year. I hear that every year, I think, because right now they're still somewhat in their winter patterns,
mm-hmm.
but they're getting out in fields more.
Sure.
So people are seeing these big flocks of turkeys, yeah. and they're like, oh, that's a bunch of turkeys.
The population is saved.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But here come early April, they're going to split mm-hmm. up, and it'll change. But even like we talked about earlier, cameras and stuff, there seems to be a pretty good amount of turkeys.
Yeah.
You know, and I hear that every year, but... I would like to think that they're kind of coming back. And I think Nate's had a similar experience on his farm. I remember a few years ago, he was like really worried about it. And now he's seeing, you know, 30 something with 7 gobblers. So.
Well, that's a really good point you brought up, because there's this group of 30 some birds that I see all the time. And I hope it's not the only group on the farm.
Yeah. yeah.
Right. Because it's like, it's a big group, but also, is it the only one? Are they all just hanging out together? Is there not 4 or 5 groups like that? Because there used to be 4 or 5 mm-hmm. or 10 groups like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I kid you not, like 2005-ish, if I would not be exaggerating to say that on our 850-acre spot there was at least 40 gobblers, you know. That's a lot of freaking turkeys.
That's a lot. But
you could go to any field at 10 o'clock in the morning in Yelp and get a couple of birds to gobble at you.
Mm.
And I guess I'm spoiled. I became spoiled because of that. And that's not the case anymore. Maybe it was an overpopulation. I don't know. But it feels now like it's under.
Yeah.
because well, of that experience. Yeah. And maybe we just need to get adjusted to knowing that there was really this point of this huge population boom. And it peaked. And maybe this is the normal.
Yeah.
And this is what a good population looks like. But
yeah,
maybe it takes some adjustment. I don't know. But it makes me want to protect what we have, because I remember that, how crazy it seemed everywhere we went. I was just showing Connor this morning this property in Reed Spring that me and Webb used to hunt. And we would go kill a turkey. It was 80 acres, right? You get there, there'd be like 3 or 4 on a limb gobbling. We'd pick one. We go sit down, call him in off the limb, kill him. Then we go to the gas station, eat a breakfast burrito, and come back, park in the same spot, step out, yelp, boom, 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 2 or 3 of them gobbling. Okay, let's just sit down by a tree and kill another one. And then we go get another buddy from college and bring him back. And we just like tore this 80 acres up. And it felt like you couldn't kill them all.
Yeah.
And just every time we go back to that 80 acres, and we would be like, oh, we've killed too many turkeys on this 80 acres. We're going to go over here and over there. And then we'd end up coming back to that place and kill them more. Uh-huh. So I don't know why, but it just felt like we never ran out of them, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. I think that, it is interesting to hear those differences, right? Because I really started seriously turkey hunting, like I think 4 years ago or something. And I remember though, a few years before that, my dad and I would get to hunt like the last few days of season, because we would actually be down in Louisiana hunting their birds. Now we were playing music, flip the script.
They've
on
killed
them.
All their birds, dude. They got none left.
Well, the hurricanes will get them too. But
a hurricane of Cajuns.
Yeah. yeah. So anyways, we'd come in like the last few days of season, you know, it's early May, and, we'd go out on a hilltop and like you could hear in the morning like 12, and it was like, holy cow. And now it's like 1, And it's just a lot different, even, you know, from those very first few turkey hunts, maybe 8 years ago for me to now. And I mean, we've had those bad conditions. And I've heard as well, I was listening to a turkey biologist not very long ago talking about how if you get a couple of good springs in a row, your turkey population can make a huge recovery just from that, because at the age they reach maturity to breed and all of that happens so quick with turkeys. Yeah. So that, you know, they ebb really quick and they go away really quick too, right? And I've definitely heard people say about, you know, we saw unnatural levels and then it's leveled off. And then maybe had a few tough years. But either way, I don't think there's anything wrong with wanting there to be a ton of turkeys everywhere. Like, as a turkey hunter, it would be weird if you felt otherwise, right?
Yeah.
So I think that regardless of what it has been, what it should be, what it's going to be, wanting better habitat is a good thing. Because in the United States, we lose, I can't remember the statistic, but it's so many acres every day of wildlife habitat that will never go back.
Yeah.
And it's up to, you know, the people who are interested in these birds to stop that. And so I think that's a good approach to take, is to be like, hey, how can we make this better just from now on every year?
Well, habitat loss is a huge deal.
Yeah.
And so we've been working on a project for 2 years, 3 years now called Prairie Prophets. And we're currently in the 6-part series. It's 6 1-hour episodes on the history of grasslands in the United States, right? And we have less than 1% of the original habitat left that was here when, you know, white people came over, right? Less than 1% of the soil has never seen an implement, a disc, a plow. So you think about that. If you think about what the wildlife was accustomed to, and that we've literally just screwed up 99% of it. It's amazing that we have wildlife left in general.
It is.
And that's really a pat on the back to all the state agencies and some of the federal projects that have happened to preserve, to restore, to work toward that, because we so quickly became a country, settled the West, then got into 2 major world wars,
mm-hmm.
which required us to plant lots and lots of corn and wheat and disc up all of this land to try to feed the world and without considering the wildlife at all, because we were thinking, well, we got to beat Germany and Japan, right? So, and it's understandable. That's not a knock on that. I think that as a country, we've tried to do what we can do to survive and to thrive. But now it's like we're looking back and going, how do we fix this a little bit? Obviously, in the 70s, the NWTF was doing that, and they started the organization that has now become such a powerhouse in the population restoration of the wild turkey. But we still have to think about that in 2025, of like, what can we do on a local level, on a personal level? What can I do on my farm? What can Connor do at the places he hunts to make sure that we're not wiping out what's left of the birds that we love so much, you know? So it's the habitat loss thing is a huge piece of that. It's a real thing.
Yeah, I think it's a huge luxury to get to say, how can we make this better, instead of having to say, how do we keep these things from going extinct?
That's right. That's true.
Like, we've been given a chance to take it from good to great, from good to better, instead of from they're gone, let's get them back, right? So it's kind of our time. You know, the baton has been passed to us. And I think, I mean, that's a big reason that I'm really trying this year to branch out more, hunt in different places, different ways, spread out that impact of one hunter, right? Like, hunting my grandpa's place is great. It's terrible habitat. I mean, you're talking about closed canopy forests of multiflora rows and then fields that sometimes get planted and sometimes don't. And it's like, just that's the way that it is, right? And so I could sit there every day for 3 weeks and probably come up with 2 turkeys off of it. But to what availment, right? Like, what good would that do anybody in the region there. And I know some of the neighbors have talked about like, well, we're not even going to hunt here because there's just not enough of them. And, you know, everybody's got to take their own approach. But it's interesting because the last day of turkey season last year, there was this flock of like 13 jakes running around down there. And I'm like, well, they're not gone. And I think sometimes if you stop hunting a place, you forget to do anything with it. You know, you don't kick around and say, okay, well, why are there no birds here? Are there no roost trees? Are there no, you know, is there no brooding cover? Is there no? So I think that like it's so important to be an active part in nature, because the answer is not to just get your hands off and let what happens happen, because with the number of invasives and all of those things that we have, like we need an active management for restoration. Like no more is the move. Just walk away and everything will be great. Is it won't. And there's nothing that makes me more fired up for habitat improvement than having a crappy hunt.
Yeah.
You know, like October 13th and I haven't seen my target buck and I'm looking around at the nothing everywhere and I'm thinking, man, why didn't I burn this last year? Why didn't I make that cut? Why didn't I do that?
Let's talk about that. Okay. So I feel like, in my opinion, not doing something is better than doing the wrong things. Mm. And let's like think about the 90s and the 2000s, because I'm obviously in that mindset right now, because we've been talking about it. Nobody was doing habitat work. Very few people were doing habitat work. There was turkeys all over the place.
Yep.
But also nobody was going in and dozing all the timber down.
Mm-hmm.
If you're listening to this, Dad.
Right.
what's that?
And they were trapping more, right?
They were
a lot of trapping.
Hunting and trapping more.
Incentive
so
for it. Yeah.
There were more. There definitely more predators were being pulled off the properties, right? Yeah. But nobody was thinking about what food plots to plant, what timber management to do, but there were lots of birds. And so I think even though the landscape had been fragmented and cut into smaller parcels because farms had been broken up and people had been plowing and planting fescue and all these things, they were still leaving the closed canopy forest. They were still leaving some of these hillsides that are erodible, that aren't great for tillage, leaving them alone. And so that's one of the reasons why your quail guys will say, that's why we had quail back then. Yeah. Because even though they weren't doing anything with that land, they were not doing the wrong things with it.
Right.
By dozing it, clearing it.
Turning it into a Dollar General.
Trying to plant something that wasn't really great for that landscape.
Oh yeah.
Example, 4 or 5 years ago, remember the hilltop next to my grandparents' house? I went and I was going to turn this place into a food plot. Mm-hmm. Well, nothing I planted worked well. And mm-hmm. I probably needed to be better at getting my soil samples and figuring that out. But what happened was, instead of all this food plot I planted working, nothing really grew. And I just had this bare hilltop. And so what would have been better is if I would have left the thing alone.
Sure.
And just left whatever grasses had popped up and whatever things, because there was some habitat value there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we get really excited about habitat improvement, but I also, the longer I've attempted habitat improvement, I realize like it's better to not do anything than to do the wrong thing. So if you're going to improve the habitat, make sure you're doing it right.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Because if you just leave something alone, wildlife will find it and we'll make a home out of it and they'll get by on it. You know,
sure.
Your whitetails probably aren't going to get the mass and the antler growth that they could if you have better nutrition and better mm-hmm. things, but they'll at least have a safe haven. So, I don't know. What do you think? Am I wrong?
So I guess it all just depends on your definition of habitat improvement, right? Because when I'm saying habitat improvement, there's a lot in my head that is going unspoken, right?
Yeah.
In my head, like habitat improvement obviously improves the habitat. And I think like a lot of times it's so easy to be like, so that means we're doing a food plot? Like, no, that's not.
Yeah.
That's not in my brain what it means, right? So like on my grandpa's farm, for an example, like I was totally like, all right, we're going in, we're thinning this out, we're cutting down the trash trees, we're doing this, we're creating light, we're going to do this, we're going to burn these spots. And then I was like doing some more research and they're like, hey, if you got a lot of invasives, do not do that. Because if you create a lot of light, you're just going to let those invasives go crazy.
Right.
And then it stopped me. Right. And that was a case where trying to do something would have been worse than doing nothing. Right. But at the same time, like you have to learn somehow. what the right move is.
True.
And so you can get completely frozen to inaction. So I think what it really comes down to is you've got to know what's best for that spot. And, you know, in our current day and age, like everybody just thinks plant a bunch of trees or make a food plot. And they totally ignore prairies, grasslands, and things like that, which is what this whole zone was, right? Like glades and all of that, right? So I don't know. Definitely, I definitely agree with your point that you don't want to get out there and do the wrong thing either. But, you know, a closed canopy forest full of multiflora rose is never going to get any better than it is like today, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Like, so doing nothing is not going to eventually make it better. It's just going to make it the same forever. And I guess, I mean, that is better than doing the wrong thing. But ideally, if you do the wrong thing, it would be a temporary thing. Say you go in and cut it, maybe it'll grow up thick, right? Or something, right? So I don't know. I mean, that is a very, I think I was painting with too broad a brush. So I appreciate you calling me out.
Well, no, I wasn't in no way trying to call you out. I was just thinking, you know, I think back to the time where there was so many birds and we just weren't really doing anything. So I know for a fact that habitat improvement as we define it today doesn't necessarily equate to more turkeys, because there were lots of turkeys and nobody was doing any habitat improvement. Yeah, so the habitat as it was obviously enough.
Yeah. Well, and so much habitat improvement is whitetail centric, and
yes,
it doesn't necessarily help the turkey, right? Yeah. And I think to Connor's point, there are a lot of factors helping out the turkeys that you don't even think about, like the fact that there was a fur market, like the fact that there were more small farms, like you mentioned, than there are now. Like, for instance, like where my mom owned a flower shop, like while I was growing up, right across from that flower shop, there would be turkeys in this field all the time. I would see them every spring, like 8 of them or 10 of them. And now guess what that is? It's a Dollar General.
Another Dollar General.
And like, so you had the birds, but you had enough habitat to make it work. And so you look at like whitetail numbers and how they're going crazy. Well, because a whitetail might bed down under a swing set. They don't care, right? Like, I mean, they care, obviously, but there's just so much more adaptive than a turkey is, right? Like a white-tailed deer can live where there are no sycamore trees.
As long as there's food.
No problem. Yeah. There's food and there's some little hole it can get in. That's all it needs. I think a turkey's just a lot more needy of a species, right?
That's funny. I was thinking about that as you were talking. Around here, our main two things, right, are deer and turkey. That's what everybody thinks about. And also kind of cutting back to what we talked to earlier, you know, local people are starting to care more about habitat, right? So they're changing things. Well, anytime you change something, that's new.
Yeah.
It's new to the deer. It's new to the turkey. It's new to everything in there, right? So those deer have been there for, you know, a mature deer is 5-6 years old. That mature deer has been in there for 5 or 6 years. Let's say you're starting on a brand new piece, whatever.
Sure.
He's been in there for 5 or 6 years and he's made it to 5 or 6, which is, that's a feat for a whitetail deer, especially around
Missouri.
Here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he's made it to 5 or 6 with absolutely nothing but natural.
Yeah.
No human manipulation at all.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you come in there and you've watched your YouTube videos and you've listened to your podcast and you've watched everybody.
Yeah.
And you're like, I'm going to make this awesome.
Uh-huh.
You go in there and you change it all up. All of a sudden that deer's like, what did you just do with my home?
Yeah.
Why did you just rearrange my home? Mm. Now, we as humans and outdoorsmen have learned enough now where a lot of the things that get implemented these days do help, right?
Yeah.
Now, that deer's going to have to adapt to it, which deer can adapt pretty well. They're hardy animals, you know, they can adapt. Whereas you were talking about people thinking about deer and turkey the same. Turkeys are very, I don't want to call that like soft or whatever, but they're a bird. They're not going to adapt as well as a deer, right?
Sure.
A deer will find food. A deer will figure out where to bed. A deer, like you said, a deer will bed in a swing set.
Yeah.
Under a swing set. Those turkeys, if you disturb it enough, they're out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they are gone for
years,
but they're gone for a while. Like, they're going to find a new home. Oh, sorry.
You're good.
I said that.
No, you're fine.
They're going to find a new home pretty quick. Whereas that deer, he'll stand up on the ridge. You don't know it, but he's going to watch you. You know, yeah. He'll watch you on your tractor. He'll watch you bulldoze down your trees or whatever.
Yeah.
And he's just going to kind of learn you. Those turkeys, they're not. They're gone. So I think that's a big change too when people are manipulating land now. You know, you can do it right, but you got to remember everything you're doing is new to the animals. And they live there every single day. They wake up and their goal is to survive.
Yeah.
And we wake up and our goal is like, I want a really pretty green food plot. Well, if you have a really pretty green food plot, that's awesome. But if you don't have roost trees, if you don't have bedding, you don't have any animals.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
There's so much that goes into that, I think. And I'm learning that now. But there's just so much goes into it. And it's a valuable resource, right? They're not making any more land every day. And a bulldozer can take down some 30, 40-year-old trees.
Yeah, man.
And they're not making any more of those in our lifetime.
Not this year anymore.
So,
I've noticed.
So it's just super valuable, and when you change stuff like that, the animals are local. That's their home, and it just makes a huge impact on them, I think.
Yeah. Well, I think to your point, like I think about my grandpa's farm and how I've seen it over these last few years. It used to be like he's got 3 or 4 bottom fields that were always in crops. Top couple fields are in hay, and there's woods wherever you can't farm. That's how that works, right? Well, then one year, the farmer who rented out the place just decided not to farm it, decided not to tell my grandpa, grew up in like 9-foot cuckoo burrs everywhere. Guess how many turkey I saw that season on my grandpa's place? None.
Yeah.
0 turkeys. The roost trees didn't change. Nothing changed. But that field, like you said, it was new. Well, then a few years later, somebody finally comes in and actually farms the place. And I shot a bird on that place this year, right? And I think a lot of times people like look at their one property and they're like, okay, turkeys are doing great. Turkeys are doing bad because of this one property. It's like, well, maybe your fields all grew up and they went 2 properties down, which is what I did 2 years ago. It's like the fields all grew up. Okay, well, I see them 2 properties down every day. There's 6 birds, so I'm going to go down there and shoot one of them. And I did. And that's just the way that it works. So it all comes to that, like, when you're looking at things so small, you forget. And like you were saying, the more you look into it, the more you learn that you need to think about. It's like, oh, I can put a food plot here, but where's my scent going? Where's this deer going to bed? Like, oh, I can burn this zone out, but are there any roost trees for these turkeys to make it to me? You know? And I think that the more you learn, the more you understand that you don't really know what needs to happen, right? And you got to just do the best you can with what you got.
And your grandpa's pastures were fescue. And so when fescue gets tall, it's such a dense species that there's no room for any animals to operate inside of it.
Oh, yeah.
So unlike a native prairie or your native warm season grasses, which get very tall, but also have room below for animals to navigate, fescue doesn't operate that way. And so that's just that habitat is no longer valuable to really any species. Fescue is a major problem that we have for, and I don't know that we really haven't considered the fact that conversion to fescue has negatively impacted our wildlife more than we know.
Yeah.
Because it is not a species that is conducive to wildlife in any way at all.
Right.
It's so dense and very little nutritional value to most wildlife. And 99% of all of our Missouri Ozarks pastures are fescue.
Yeah.
converting a lot of that back to native grasses, I think, would immediately help our wildlife.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
It's also billions of dollars.
That's the thing is,
because we've already done this for the last 80 years.
We came and we replaced the buffalo with the cattle, right? That's like what happened. And you're not going to just undo that because you think it's cool, right? Like I would love so much to see grasslands instead of hay fields, right? Like for instance, my neighbor who decided to not turkey hunt anymore, his place used to be the best turkey spot. And every day of season, there were multiple gobblers in this one creekside field every single day. And guess what it's in now? Fescue. And guess how many turkeys I see on that field now? None. I never hardly see them over there. Like, I'll see them sometimes, but I mean, not hardly. Not like they used to be when it was a fallow field in the spring. And it was, there was like a hilltop with good roost trees. They would fly down into that field and you couldn't get to those. That was the other thing though, is you couldn't get to those turkeys. Like when I had permission to hunt it before he bought it, they put themselves in an impervious location and that's why they were there.
Yeah.
Right. But now it's hay fields and no turkeys.
And turkeys will operate in fescue pretty well as long as it's been either grazed down or mowed down, because it's low and they can get to their bugs. They can see those things. But if it gets any length at all, any growth at all, that there's no value in it for them.
And I feel like gobblers don't like to strut in it as much because they can't really drag their wingtips, you know?
Oh, I got you.
Yeah. I don't know that, like, just in past looking at hay fields versus like fallow fields. Well, not fallow fields. I'm using the wrong word. Plowed fields. Bare dirt. There we go. That's a term I can't get wrong. Bare dirt. They always, to me, seem to prefer the bare dirt. Okay, if they can get
to worms and all kinds of food better. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
A lot of plowed up bare dirt around here has actually been seeded. So
and they get seeds too.
What you're seeing as well.
Yeah, extra.
I pulled up this quote. We'll read it real quick.
Oh, good.
But it's John Madsen. He wrote this book called Tallgrass Prairie, right? And so I use this quote in one of the episodes of Prairie Prophets. And I just thought it was really interesting to me, especially when you're thinking about the bird that we love, right? So this quote is, it's as if we cannot get on with the exploiting of original things and places swiftly enough. Mm. In desperate haste, like children gobbling cake, we plunder the pelf of the continent, the great prairies, the bison herds, the redwood forests. Then, when only vestiges remain, we recant. We suddenly realize we knew almost nothing about them. They had been nearly destroyed before given a chance to instruct us. And so on the second time around, we begin to view them with a reverence and sense of worth of which they should have been addressed in the first place. Mm. And so it's like, you know, us as Americans, and like I said earlier, I don't think, you know, we've done what we had to do to try to make a country and to try to survive and to create an agricultural system that works. But also, as when only vestiges remain, we recant and then we try to fix it. And so I think that that's been like also the pattern of our conservation efforts is, oh crap, the turkey's gone. What do we do? And WTF pops up, right? Oh no, we've killed a lot of elk. Then Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation decides, well, there's a place for us. Quails Forever, Pheasants Forever, all of these organizations, they don't come out of a surplus of wildlife. They come out of a decreasing population of wildlife. Why do we have this trend where when we've almost completely screwed the pooch, we decide to fix it, right? It's like, can we not decide before we get to that place that we need to establish things that protect things?
It's the human condition, right? Yeah. Like, I remember a couple of years ago, I had this thought about my own life that I realized, like, I was only happy in hindsight. Mm-hmm. I would always think back to that turkey hunt or that fishing trip or whatever. And I was like, man, that was so cool. That was one of the best years of my life or whatever. And I just realized that it was such a trend where all I was ever doing was looking back. And I decided then, like, hey, I'm not going to just be happy in hindsight anymore. I am going to live every day, like, understanding what I have, what I've been blessed with, right? So, like, in this attempting to improve and manage and improve the numbers of turkeys and stuff, you know, we still have a lot of birds to chase. There's still a lot of really cool stuff going on out there that you can see. And I think that any day you go in the woods with an open mind, you're going to come away with a cool experience.
Yep.
You know, it might rain. You might never see a turkey, but you might see an earthworm, you know, that's like as big as your shoelaces. And it's like, hey, that's cool. Right. And so I think that there needs to be appreciation for those small things, like you were like with that quote, while we have it, right? Not just after we've squandered it, to later appreciate it, but to appreciate it right now. And whether it used to be better or worse, to appreciate it for what it is right now, you know. I think the best way that I love to do that, especially this time of year, is thinking about just different turkey trips I've been on and stuff, you know, and things like that. Do you guys like, I don't know, when do you sometimes like not remember a story until you're in the place that like it happened again? Like every time I start walking the woods in the spring, I'm like, oh yeah, I busted a turkey there. Oh yeah, I got busted by a turkey there.
Yeah.
Like all that happens to me a lot for sure. But have you guys been thinking about any of your turkey stories this year so far? Or?
Oh yeah. There's always that. We're always pondering on old stuff and, you know, you think about old stories and you're like, man, I want that to, you know, I wish I could, let's try to do that again or whatever. Yeah. But that's one thing about a turkey hunt is it's never going to happen the same way twice normally. You always think about that and you, what drives me more, like you were talking about, you were thinking about always like, man, that was a fun time or that was a fun mm-hmm. hunt or whatever. I get more driven by the future. Like,
sure.
You know, sure. I've done those things, but those are cool stories to tell and memories to share with people. But we've got a lot more stories and memories to make.
Like, absolutely.
So that's part of it, you know.
Not Nathaniel, though. He's too old. But for us.
We've got so much time.
We've got a lot of time ahead of us.
Yeah, they're calling hospice.
Yeah, but, you know, that's thinking about stories. Thinking about stories is fun, but thinking about what can happen and what will happen, like just as we sit here this spring, you know, everything we talk about, I think about, man, it'd be cool to kill a turkey off that ridge or whatever. It'd be cool mm-hmm. to have one fly down into that bottom and shoot him off the roost or anything like that, you know. Will those two things happen? I mean, I'm going to go with no, because normally when you kill a turkey, it's not how you pictured it.
But, not the truth.
Yeah. So, it's fun to think about. It's fun to think about the past. It's really fun to think about the future for me.
Oh yeah, that anticipation can be way better than the season ever is, right? Yeah. Like just getting all prepared and stuff.
Yeah. Well, and I don't care what people say. People say they hunt because they want to kill a big buck or they want to kill a big turkey, but most people don't. They may not realize it, but they're out there because they're excited for what's going to happen.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You know, and you're also excited for after it happens, right? After you kill that big deer. But, or, you know, great, good turkey. But after that happens, you're also like, well, now what?
Yeah.
You never feel that way before. You never feel that way before. Yeah. So that's a big part of it.
It's about the journey, not the destination. Is that what you're getting at?
Sure, yeah. Yeah.
I was thinking this year, there was this tree that's in this, I don't know, this tree I used to be able to go on our family farm and sit down and, it was like gold. You could set that spot almost any day and bird would fly down in this little field. But my dad, who I love, and he's a great farmer. He's gotten a bulldozer that he's very fond of and he's removed a lot of our forest. So this one ridge where these turkeys were always at, and me and Bub used to say, like, this is the best field in the state of Missouri to kill a turkey in, because mm-hmm. you could, four or five of them will be out there strutting in any given morning. But it's not been the same. There's still some turkeys that fly down in that field from time to time, but not like it was. And so anyway, this year I was thinking I'm going to just sit against that same tree every single morning until one of them comes in. No, you won't. Connor doesn't believe me. No, you won't. At least start my morning there.
But yeah. See, it sounds good.
It sounds good.
In your mind, you're like, yeah, I want to do
it. Because romanticize this crap.
Exactly. We all romanticize
it. That's what it is. It's the romance of it. Yeah. Yeah. I always struggle hunting memories too much, you know. And hunting memories is worth doing. Yeah. But it's probably not your most productive way to do it. You know, I can go back to this farm pond that's, you know, been drained and there's no fish in it anymore. And I can toss that worm lure up against the bank where I caught that 4-pounder the one day, but he ain't going to be there.
Yeah, but if there's still water in the pond, the unknown is still there.
So you're saying there's a chance.
So that's where I'm at, dude. Yeah. You're saying there's a chance. I don't know, man. I connect these memories to this bird more than, this like possible success. It's just an interesting, you don't do that with deer hunting. You don't do that with any other, but it's just like, there's this nostalgia. There's these memories. They're so strong, where it causes us to just get out and try to do crazy things to try to relive something that was such an incredible experience at one point, you know?
It's like in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, where he always talks about, like, I reckon she's looking for answers. I had forgotten about that being like a theme of that movie, but we rewatched it the other day. And I was
what a great movie.
I kind of feel like that's what you're doing when you're turkey hunting. You're kind of looking for answers. Yeah. You're not even sure what the questions are, right? But you're looking for something. You're chasing a feeling. You're chasing a bird, but that's not really what you're chasing, right?
Yeah. Have you considered the lilies of the field?
That's it, man. Absolutely. Consider the lilies of the GD field.
Great freaking line, man.
Oh my goodness. Every line is great. Connor, have you seen Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
I have, yeah. Good. It's been a while. I don't watch a ton of movies, but
it's weird.
It's incredibly strange.
It's a good movie. I like it.
I was so young watching that movie that, like, you ever be so familiar with a thing that you don't even recognize it for what it is?
Yeah.
Because you just recognize it as a thing. So I didn't even think about that movie as, like, extremely comedic. Like, in my mind, it's a dead serious movie at all times. And it's just not that at all. That doesn't have much to do with turkey hunting, but it has a lot to do with my life.
Dude, the music is like that for me. There'll be a 90s country song that I've heard thousands of times. Mm-hmm. And then every now and then I'll just be listening to it by myself and I've never actually listened to it. And it hits you like an emotional way. You're like, oh, I know every word of this song, but I never knew knew this song.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
The song Rocky Top.
Yeah.
You know, the verse, once two strangers climbed old Rocky Top looking for a moonshine still. I thought that was people from the city because of the light pollution was so bad they couldn't even see the moon. So they went to Rocky Top to see the beautiful stars at night. And the strangers haven't come down from Rocky Top. Reckon they never will. And it was because the night sky was so beautiful. And like, as an adult, I'm like, wait a minute. That's not what a moonshine still is. They're not still looking for the moonshine. Just goes to show you the absolute clever poeticism from the great state of Tennessee.
The same thing goes for a Limp Bizkit song. You listen to Break Stuff, it really, you've heard it, but have you heard it?
Have you really pondered the deeper meaning? See, this is why no one hangs out with me. I run up to them. I'm like, have you pondered the deeper meanings of Rocky Top? And they're like, go away from me. It's just sad, dude. It's sad. This is just, you're built different. And that's why it's important to have friends that hunt, because they're the same kind of weird as you, right?
That's like, right.
Connor, you've mentioned several times hunting in terms of we, which is so cool.
Because
I get to hunt in terms of just me almost exclusively, because you can only guilt shame your dad into turkey hunting with you so many times. But I got a few more, but with you and like your buddies and stuff going around and hunting, how'd that come to be? Did you just grow up with these fellers or what? Yeah. Tell me a little bit about what you do with them and all that.
Well, I've grown up with a very strong core group of friends, and that came through sports when I was younger, really young. And then I didn't really play sports through high school, but they all did, and I stayed, you know, same friend group and all that. Mm-hmm. And anyway, it's just kind of a lot of them have stayed around here, really, for the most part. If they moved away, they come back almost every weekend. Their families might still be here. Just with Lebanon, A lot of people either hate it, or you get your core group of guys and they're like, this is where I grew up and this is it. Like, Lebanon's it. So that's where that came from. We grew up all hunting together. All of our dads kind of taught us how to hunt or whatever. And we kind of flocked to each other and we've stayed that way forever. And I don't know if it's because now we all hunt very similarly and it's almost like we kind of understand each other differently than these other people do. We take it pretty serious. I mean, you know, there's other people that take it serious too, but there's our group, we take it really serious and we like to think we're good at it. If you can be good at hunting,
you can.
Yeah. You can be good. You can be lucky. You can be all that, but you know, we pay a lot of attention to it and, you know, it's led to some awesome things. I've been probably some of my greatest memories, if not my greatest memories, have come from hunting trips with my buddies.
Yeah.
Whether that be locally or going to Colorado or wherever we end up, you know, those trips are just the best. And you're taking your hometown buddies, you're taking home on the road with you, kind of.
Sure.
And out there to Colorado, and you still got your great friends, and you know you guys will be back home and talking about it next week or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's just it. Yeah. Hunting to me is we a lot. I very rarely hunt by myself. That also takes one of the reasons that is because of the filming thing as well.
Oh, sure.
But, I still don't know if all my friends moved away right now, I would either have to make new friends or I would just be really bored hunting. I'd just be wandering around the woods like, where'd my friends go?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just, hunting is for us, it's very social, even though, mm-hmm. you know, deer hunting, it's a quiet, you know, you gotta be quiet and all that, but mm-hmm. we all just kind of get each other and, we want to just share the experiences with each other.
Yeah. So are you mostly the film guy or do you switch off a lot or what?
Yep. As far as my friend group, I'm mostly the film guy. So I Nate had a part of this too in the beginning. We actually it was Nate.
I did?
And I, yeah, it was Nate and I at first. We created a thing called The Road.
Mm-hmm.
So when I first started working,
very popular with car drivers.
Yes, very popular car drivers.
I didn't know you were the one behind it.
Yeah, yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy, huh? Their idea of The Road. Yeah, yeah. There's also a movie called The Road. So if you just search The Road, you'll find some like apocalyptic movie. I can't even say it, but anyway. Nate, when I first started at Sling Glass, which is what I do now, and mm-hmm. film guy, Nate wanted me to kind of have a project of my own.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously the reason I got into filming was because of hunting. So
sure.
Obviously that generated towards, well, I want a hunting show on, you know, just like yeah. everybody. I was 21 at the time. I would have been 21. So, obviously, you know, I want to do a hunting show with my buddies. We were all yeah. in college. I was kind of on the verge of being out of college, whatever, but we had time.
Yeah.
And also COVID hit, which was different. That gave us a lot of time. But anyway, so Nate's, we start thinking this idea. And Nate, he's done some stuff like this as well, having some shows. And you kind of work with some brands and whatnot and have a YouTube channel. Well, yeah, whatever. Have a show.
Yeah.
So anyway, I remember we spent lots of time trying to think of a name and logos and trips and trying to, Nate was contacting people to see if we could do this. But all this came about because he wanted me to kind of have my own thing
yeah.
to learn. Mm-hmm. This was all a learning experience.
Oh, sure, yeah.
All for me to figure out, hey, you got to go do this. The only way you're going to learn is to do it.
By doing it, yeah. Yep.
So this was a great opportunity for me to learn as well as for me to give my friends some cool opportunities as yeah. well. It all just kind of worked together. I don't know. It's really crazy how it all worked together, and you know, there's reasons for that. But
hold on 1 second. So you do all the filming of your buddies' hunts, and you yeah. line up hunts for them.
Well,
have you ever considered that you have been conned?
Well, I was going to tell you that the thing about Connor is that Connor is literally one of the most humble people I know. Connor has friends who he features on all these awesome videos. His Buddy Cole killed a huge deer last year. Wouldn't have happened without Connor.
Mm.
We've shot music videos for amazing artists. Wouldn't have happened without Connor.
Yeah.
All these things happen that would not happen without Connor, but he doesn't get to be the guy who like gets all the praise.
Mm.
And the crazy thing is he's okay with that because he's a humble guy. He's literally one of the most humble people I know. One of the most honest and reliable human beings on the planet who I love. He doesn't like people telling them. He doesn't like me telling him I love him. I love you. he's a one in a million kind of person because most people want to be an influencer, but Connor influences by close relationships, not by some social media deal.
Yeah.
His influence is with his friends and his family and those who are close to him. And, it's really powerful. So
yeah, because you're saying like, you know, I want to do a show, so does everybody. But you don't want to do a show so you can be the show. You want to do the show so the show gets done. And I was just that's noticing right. that in what you're saying. Yeah. Like, that's a different level of appreciation of the thing, right? It's
yeah.
just like, I want this to happen no matter what. Do you feel like getting to be the guy behind the camera, do you feel like there's more or less pressure on you? Because, you know, the guy being filmed, if you screw that shot up, Everybody gets to watch that happen, which, I mean, the same thing can happen behind the camera, right? But I know that sometimes, like, when I go out with buddies or whatever, and I'm just calling or whatever, I'm like, oh, thank goodness.
Yeah.
The pressure's off a little. Yeah. Or do you feel, what do you feel with that?
There's, so filming, it comes with some pressure as well. A lot of, so the way things are set up for me and the road and how it's set up, it's all, like, I'm in charge of it, right? So. Yeah. If something happens and I don't get the kill shot, then sure, I guess I'm mad at myself. I didn't get the kill shot. Sure. Whatever. You can still tell and make a great hunting video without a kill shot.
Yeah.
I promise you can. You don't need the kill shot. But the kill shot helps. Anyway, yeah, there's some pressure there. More so the pressure is I've got to, you know, you're in the same situation as the guy hunting, pulling the trigger. Except you've got the camera, you've got to make sure it's recording, you've got to make sure it's in focus, you've got to make sure your batteries aren't dying, you've got to make sure, yeah, I mean, you know, there's a lot of stuff that goes into it. The more you do it, the more it's kind of streamlined, you know?
Yeah.
It's almost, I'm to the point now where it's almost second nature. I don't even,
yeah,
a lot of that stuff I don't think about, I don't worry about, mm-hmm. you know? But there's, I mean, yeah, there's pressure to it as well.
Yeah.
I would almost say, in my situation, and like one of the main, well, the main guy I film is Cole McBride. And I think we work well because I don't feel pressured like filming him. But if it was vice versa and I had to shoot and he was filming me, I would be like, oh, I'm going to mess this up. Like, I'm gonna miss. I'm going to, you know, hit it back or forward or whatever. Sure. And, you know, that comes with confidence and time, right?
Absolutely.
I haven't filmed as long as a lot of people, but I've filmed a lot of different situations and I've filmed a lot of things and I'm pretty confident in it, in my ability to film, which is great. It's comfortable to be that way.
Yeah.
So I have a lot more fun and I'm way more comfortable filming than I would be trying to shoot something.
Sure.
Yeah. I would be way more fired up.
Yeah.
In a good way.
Oh yeah.
But I would be like, and I have. I mean, last year I shot a deer with my bow, didn't find it. Cole filmed it. It actually lived. And then I self-filmed me shoot my own deer.
Okay.
Which, looking back on the self-film thing now, I was just as much trying to get the shot on the film as I was like trying to shoot the deer. And so,
yeah, you kind of have to be.
My head just worked both ways at one time. And
yeah,
looking back on it, I'm like, I can't believe I even thought of that. But I
didn't. Yeah. Well, that's what you have to do. Like, that's one thing I've learned from trying to film stuff is like, you got to do both jobs just as good, or you might as well not even bring the stinking camera. Right. Cause like, there's nothing worse than getting bad footage and screwing up your chance.
Yeah. Well, like, self-filming is extremely hard, and anyone that's able to do it successfully is you're really good at just a really good outdoor.
Yeah, they're a different level. Yeah,
that's the thing about filming hunts, and Nate can attest to this, but you can take a great outdoorsman and teach him how to run a camera and he'll do good.
Yeah.
But you can't take a non-outdoorsman or, you know, let's just say a city guy and throw him on it who's really good at already filming and throw him on a hunt.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not going to work.
He's not going to see the right things.
No, he's not going to see the right things. Your guy who's hunting is they're not going to get along. I can guarantee that. It's not going to work.
Yeah. So. Well, similar, I think, with like music videos. Like, you ever see a music video and you're like, so not a single musician behind these cameras, right? Or in the edit, the editing room is what really gets me, is like, they're showing some shot that was like from a minute ago that the guitar was playing. And I'm like, can you not hear? But yeah, same thing, like you're saying, like with filming. So in your self-filming and then filming other people, what are some like things you've learned, some little takeaways for people out there that like to do that or maybe want to get into that, that maybe they should think about?
If you're going to get into it, just do it. Go get the footage.
Yeah.
A lot of people are like, man, I just don't know how do I do this and what do I film or whatever. I said, well, you can't edit it. You can't put it together if it's not there. You have to film
Absolutely.
It. I don't care if you're filming with your phone, if you go buy brand new cameras and try to learn how to use them
yeah,
great. But you have to film, and back to the learning thing, and you won't, you're not going to learn how to do it unless you do it.
That's it.
So you have to do it. And if it feels intimidating, just jump into it.
Yeah.
And just do it. And it might be intimidating. If you're really taking it serious, you're probably going to mess up something, you know?
Yeah.
There's that fine line with especially deer and turkeys as well and all that. You know, you might have a once in a lifetime opportunity at a deer. If you're trying to film it and you mess that up, weigh your options, right? What do you want?
Yeah.
But the more you do it, the more you learn, and the more you're gonna figure it out, and you're gonna figure out that you probably carry too much stuff into the woods at first. You're gonna figure out that the way you're setting your cameras up in the tree, you're killing yourself doing it that way. You're gonna learn all those things when you start doing it. But you can ask people for tips, and you can watch YouTube, which is a huge help.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not going to learn anything unless you do it.
Yeah.
So, go do it.
I like it, man. You know, we have a producer who says, we can't delete it if we don't record it.
Yeah, there you go.
You got to get that footage and then delete. Like, I think about the first time I tried to video like a bow fishing trip. I was like, this is going to be great. This is going to be incredible. People don't even know what they're about to see. And then I get back and I'm like, yeah, so turns out pitch black, except for 10 feet in front of the boat where it's brighter than the sun, is incredibly hard to film.
Yep.
That's a good point.
You know, you learned it.
I learned it. And then next time I made sure to make the exact same mistake. So that's a tip not a lot of people will tell you, is make sure you make the same mistake 3 or 4 times be sure it's a mistake.
Yeah, you're going to do that.
Ooh, I don't know about that.
Well, that's what I do for some reason.
Yeah. I learned how not to pack too much stuff because I had to go film with Cam Haynes up on a mountaintop. Whoa. And I realized I need to take just as many red brick batteries as I need and not any extras.
Uh-huh.
That was one of the you have to climb a mountain with a bag on your back. You really got to figure out what you need.
Right. You got to keep up with an ultra marathon runner.
Right. It was one of those moments where I was like, I'm not going to forget this. I remember being halfway up the mountain and being like, I'm thinking about just ditching a bunch of this and buying it later.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's one of those things. The opportunity would be amazing, but I don't know if
I would
want to go film Cam Haynes.
I would turn it down immediately. Yeah, like I know who I am. Yeah, yeah. No way.
Yep.
But you did it.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
How about that?
Yeah, I did it.
But you did it.
That's crazy. Yeah. So don't see. I still struggle with overpacking big time. Not only just hunting, but especially self filming. And then when I'm doing both of them by myself, like I feel like I need to just like train up a mule like Clay Newcomb and just like take it to haul all my gear, even though I'm going 100 yards from the truck.
Yes.
How do you guys like to like narrow it down some? Cause like, okay. So for instance, I'll just lay it out. I like to have at least a decoy. Sometimes I'll even bring 3 because I'm not a great turkey hunter. And then like I'll bring like a couple calls. And then like what always happens to me in the spring is like it's 30 degrees before the sun goes up and it's 90 when I'm going to the house. So, you know, like I've got a whole extra layer of clothes that are, you know, random stuff I've bought. They're not your packable, windproof, you know, weigh 3 ounces, $500 shirts. And I just like I end up feeling like I need all this stuff. And then, you know, I get out there and I use half of it. And then the next time I bring half the stuff and then I wish I had it the whole time. But what's like going through your guys' head when you're thinking about like, okay, what are the essentials? And what should I just leave behind?
Well, I mean, when it comes to that, that's going to be different with camera gear versus just hunting gear, right?
Yep.
But, camera gear side, we'll talk about that. It's come a long way. If you saw photos of what Nate used to film with, and it used to be worse even way back then, but, I mean, it was ridiculous.
Way back then. 2017,
way back
bro.
Then, dude.
No, way back then. I'm talking about...
Oh, I got you.
Yeah, this camera's like 20...
You're talking about like VHS stuff back when I was in high school or whatever. Yeah.
Anyway, but yeah, it's come such a long way. But I think back in 2017, there was no better way to do it.
Red camera was heavy. And if you either had... You either wanted good footage or you had to take a DSLR. So it was heavy. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. Nowadays, with my situation, things are cameras have come such a long way.
Oh yeah.
You can do it pretty light. And action cams are great nowadays. GoPros used to be like good enough, I guess. But now the new GoPros and the DJIs and all that, really, really awesome. And you can pack stuff in pretty light. As far as the gear or the, you know, what you're wearing and all that, it's kind of just how cold you want to be in the morning or how hot you want to be in the midday.
I got to get tougher, man. Yeah. I just got to get tougher is the issue.
Figure that out. Turkey hunting the same way, you know, I'll be out there in the morning. It's 40 degrees and, but it's going to hit 80. So you might be cold as you're hooting to one on the roost, but it's going to warm up. So
yeah,
I don't know. It's kind of just what it is.
I like a good quality hoodie, like the Shin hoodie or the new Mossy Oak Woodsman hoodie that I got.
Yeah.
I feel like those really nice ones with a base layer, it's like you can get by with a hoodie in the morning when it's super cold, and then you just throw it in the back of your vest and, you know, run with your long sleeves after that.
I don't know what that material is called, like the Woodsman series, but it's like super warm, but then super breathable too.
Yeah.
I don't know what they call it, but they've figured it out.
It's magic,
I guess.
Magic. Yeah.
It's magic.
So with cameras, are you bring in like two usually then? Cause like, you know, your action camera or whatever, I always find like that's great for getting the hunter, getting closer, whatever. But you know, if the animal is more than 5 yards away, it looks like it's 100 yards away on an action camera. So do you have some sort of zoom or fixed lens that you bring? What do you bring for that?
So
pause. I'm going to pee.
It's all right. We can
answer that question. Okay.
I'll everyone answer. Just needs to know that he has left the building for a moment. We can keep going. It's okay.
So, as far as packing in cameras, if I'm self filming, I'll normally take a smaller DSLR or mirrorless camera. Now, I always say DSLR, but I'll take a smaller mirrorless camera. I've got an R6. I had an R6, sold an R6, bought an R6. Don't ask me why.
As you do.
There's more story to that. But anyway, and the R6 is a few years old camera. Anyway, you can buy them pretty affordable now.
Yeah.
And for what I'm doing for my YouTube channel, it works out great. So if I'm self-filming, I'll just take the R6 with probably a 24 to 105 if I'm in a tree.
Okay.
And then I'll also take an action cam, like a DJI. I love the DJIs. Mm-hmm. They're killer.
They are.
And I'll take a action cam, and I'll have that. The action cam is just for me, the subject. You know, I'm not using it. If I get like the perfect, awesome over the shoulder shot of shooting a deer, awesome. But the action cam just for me.
Yeah.
The mirrorless camera is going to be on a tree arm.
Yep.
Elevate tree stands. They make an awesome tree arm. They make a couple of them. Really killer tree arm, super lightweight, made for mobile hunting, and it's just a killer tree arm. So I'll take that. And I try to avoid self-filming as much as possible.
Yeah.
Like I'm probably calling three dudes before I decide to self-film. And even then, I'm like, are they really going to move today? Like, do I have to do this?
Yeah.
You know, and other one, or I'll be like, hey, I don't want to self film myself. Can I go film you? What are you
doing? Yeah.
Anyway,
you'd rather go film someone else than to self film.
Yeah. Anyway, but then a lot of times gun hunting around here, we're hunting on the ground. So if I'm not walking too far, I'll take a tripod with the small mirrorless camera, depending on what lens. A lot of times I'll take a 70 200 and put it on the tripod where I can take the mirrorless camera off the lens, off the tripod, if that makes sense. And then throw on a selfie video or selfie lens if I want to do that.
Okay, sure.
And then I'll still have the DJI running just as a camera towards me as I'm doing that.
Yeah.
A good example of that. So I've got a video on the YouTube channel, The Road Outdoors. It was my deer I killed this past season. It was a just a solid mainframe 8 with a couple kickers. And self-filmed it with a muzzleloader. I got lucky, but it's kind of just it was a really good showcase of self-filming, I guess. And I don't self-film hardly ever.
Yeah.
But I was able to do that really well. And it's kind of just second nature, but, if I'm filming other people, I've got a bigger cinema camera that I'll take. And, that's just like, you're going to have to lug it up the tree. You're going to have to bring your battery. Now, the batteries, but all that stuff's pretty small nowadays. They're not big old bricks, like red bricks, like he was talking about earlier and stuff. But And I'll still take the action cam to put on my buddies and whatever, because it all matches pretty well.
Yeah.
And this year.
Go ahead.
I was saying this year for turkey season, I want to do the cinema camera with the mirrorless camera as like a second wide angle. Just to see if it works.
Interesting. So what's getting on the turkey then?
It'll be me filming. Yeah.
Okay.
I won't self film a turkey hunt. That's just going to ruin my day. Yeah.
What?
Yeah. I might end up still filming a turkey hunt. But yeah, I just don't want to carry that stuff. Normally the way I turkey hunt, if I'm by myself, I'm doing something that's like going to somewhere I've never been, or
yeah,
I'm figuring something out, and I don't know. I might do the whole Pinhati approach this year with the buckle strap and a super small camera or something. Just to get it.
Yeah.
They say content's king, right? So
they do say that.
Some people, depending on what you're doing, quantity over quality, right?
Yeah.
So I get best of both worlds working at Slant and Glass.
I say good memories are king. So
good memories are king. Yeah, I think about
for sure.
Yeah, I think about the buck I shot last year. I had everything ready to roll, and he came through chasing a doe, and I never even once thought about turning the camera on, because it was like, you've got 3 seconds, make your choice.
Yeah.
You can get some bad footage of him, or you can shoot him.
Yeah.
And it was not a hard choice.
Yeah.
Yep. But
yeah,
I don't know. I know that when I first started trying to take cameras and stuff, like, I told myself, like, okay, you have to commit to doing this every time or no times, because the cool stuff is always going to happen when you left the camera. And so it's just part of my stuff always. And like, and I'm not even trying to like do a YouTube channel or anything. To me, getting good footage of something is almost as good as shooting it, right? Like if I got some decent footage of a gobbler strutting, I'm like, I won today. Like it's great. And so like I bring camera stuff just because, you know, I want to be able to film it. And yeah, it is always frustrating when just stuff escapes. I'm trying to think. I don't think I've knowingly lost out on anything yet from cell filming, because like in the illustration of that deer, I didn't even try to film. I was like, I'm shooting this deer. But like, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier, how you want different things as you go.
Yeah.
And you know, there'll be a day when it's going to matter more to me to get a great shot on camera than to just get this thing killed no matter what. Mm-hmm. I just am not there yet. But yeah. I probably will be eventually.
Well, also for what we're doing with the YouTube stuff, I will never tell one of my friends not to shoot because it's not on camera if they want to shoot or if they get the chance.
Yeah.
Never will. If they have the opportunity and they want to shoot it, that's fine. I don't care. It's their hunt. I'm filming it. So maybe that wide angle will get them shooting it. You know, I'm not like that. We've got plenty of videos, and I'm not going to make someone wait if they don't want to wait.
So yeah.
That's another thing. But yeah.
It always stresses me out to death watching, like, I've been watching all the Hunt and Public's turkey videos, you know, and every video, you on him.
Yeah.
You on him. Yeah.
Yeah.
And like, I love that they do that. Like, thank goodness, right? Like, it makes great content. Yeah. But I don't know that I could ever have that kind of discipline.
Yeah.
But it would probably be good for me to do that, because maybe I would be less target panicky if I would wait a second. Because it is always surprising how sometimes you have so much more time than you think, and then how sometimes you have so much less time than you think.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that can be the case. And a lot of that comes down to the creative side. I have the creative side. My buddies don't. A few of them have kind of adapted some of the creative side just from being around it. And
yeah,
and they see what we make. They don't realize what videoing hunts can be until they see it.
Yeah.
And they're like, holy crap, that's what you're out here doing? It's like, I'm filming you. And
yeah,
it's like, dang, that was cool. Like, you got me doing all kinds of stuff. I look really cool in that shot, whatever. And
so, I had to cut the 3 other takes of you doing weird stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Why do you always throw your arm out like that?
Yeah, exactly. There's a bunch of stuff.
You just like get mad at your talent all the time. They're not even there. You're like, why do you keep doing that?
Yeah.
I'm not sure you could refer to any of your friends as talent. But
I think if they're listening to this, they're probably like, yeah, I agree.
No, they're good. They're good dudes.
They're good guys. I'm just kidding. Yeah, though. And they've adapted. Like, I'll give them credit. As far as the film and hunt thing, and they've seen what it can be and stuff, because we've been able to make some pretty cool videos over the years. They're all kind of in it now. They're like, man, let's see if we can and see, we want to make good videos, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, we do want to kill deer and kill turkeys, and that's what we're doing. Mm-hmm. We're also trying to do it on camera as well as possible. And that's a big part of it. Like, for sure, there's times where my buddy Cole hasn't gone hunting because I couldn't go that night or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. If it's a good night, obviously, you know, if things are aligning, you got to go. And he'll self-film, for sure. I'll give him credit on that. He'll self-film. But, yeah, it's just after they saw the videos, they're like, oh, that's cool. You know, it's like, dude, put the camera away. You're going to scare my whatever.
Probably also depends on your level of investment in the specific thing. Like, Cole wasn't going to go hunt droppy without you because you've been filming it the entire time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. So like there's a story here that's been building and we've been filming and covering so that then that availability of you to be there with the camera just gets more and more important as you continue to go through the process, the more the story unfolds.
Yeah.
Like with my son, he's killed 5 turkeys by the time he was 9 and I hadn't filmed any of them. And that was really intentional. I didn't want to. I wanted him to have his first turkey hunting memories to be just that.
Just memories.
Right, because to me, my memories are really important. And I think maybe if I saw them replayed to me, like there was a hidden camera or something I didn't know about, they might not be as magical or something. You know what I mean?
For sure. Mm-hmm.
Because your brain can like romanticize your experiences. And so I want him just to have that. I might film him this year. I don't know. Because as I evolved in my hunting, just like I was saying this morning, we were watching back some footage of me and my buddies in college, and it was cool to see that because I was like, oh, I forgot about that. That's a cool memory. When I stepped on that turkey's head and almost rolled down the holler, you know? but so I think that it just depends on what your intentions are with it. Like, you know, for me and my son Maverick right now, it's been have good memories with dad, but maybe as he kills more turkeys, it's like, oh, let's preserve a few of these things.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I always remember a hunt differently than like any of them that I videoed. Like I think about a turkey I shot a couple years ago, like in my head, these 3 gobblers came in, thrashed my decoy, one separated out and stood still and lifted his head. And then I slowly squeezed the trigger. When I watched the film, that turkey takes one jump back and I shoot him. Like there was almost no time between those two things. And I thought, wow, because in my mind, he was standing stock still and everything just worked out.
The problem with film is it proves you wrong.
Well, it did, man. It super did.
It really does. It's like, man, I had a totally different vision of this experience.
Yeah, it's like, oh, I was lucky to have hit that bird. And, you know, your adrenaline slows things down. So that's like all. Yeah. But I can't think of the number of times it's helped me with like a deer trail or whatever, like, oh, it went by this tree. I thought it went by this tree. And I've always been bad about that for whatever reason. And nothing exposes how bad you are at remembering things like shooting a deer and not immediately finding it. And you're like, did I see a deer? I'm not even sure.
Was that deer I shot at?
Did I shoot at one? Is there a shell casing?
Large possum.
Like, yeah, it just, you know, your mind can play tricks on you. But I think that is so good, like giving your son the chance to, like, live in a world where he's not being, like, seen by all for everything, right? Like, I mean, for my childhood, I don't know about you, Connor, you're just a little bit younger than me, like, 3 years younger than me. But I was able to grow up in a world where every stupid and weird thing I did wasn't documented.
Yeah.
And thank goodness. A lot of it was, though, because of playing music, and my grandpa used to just, like, film all of our shows. So, like, I can still go back and see me saying the weirdest things possible, you know, in front of an audience.
Well,
because I didn't care, but
there's no way for our world not to be documented now. Like, even though I haven't filmed all of Maverick's kills, we've gotten, you know, him going after the bird after he's killed it. We've gotten lots of footage.
Yeah.
But just those core moments of, like, how that hunt actually went down is like, it's a memory. It's not a,
it's between you and him.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And that's intentional because everything is filmed now. I mean, our phones are always out filming everything. And, that's weird, you know, because I did grow up in that world where that wasn't the case. And I have so many memories of specifically bow hunting when I was young, cause I picked up a bow when I was 11 and I started hanging tree stands with plywood and, you know, just somehow I could hobble up at a tree. And I remember core memories of shooting lots of freaking does. And killing very few of them, but shooting lots of them.
Oh, no.
But I have all these memories that, like, I really feel like if I had a video of it, it would ruin it. So,
yeah,
I don't know.
There's another thing to that, too, for Nate's side, I think. When you're filming hunts, you're there in the hunt, but you're there through the screen.
In the screen, in the hunt, right? That's totally different.
So if Nate, for this case, if Nate was filming Maverick on you know, getting all his first birds,
yep.
Nate's not.
He's not there.
His memory of that is looking through the screen.
Yeah.
You're not there with your son sitting there watching him, watching the turkey come in. You're sitting there looking at the screen, looking at making sure your eyes is right or whatever.
It's right.
Yeah.
And it takes
you. Is this in focus?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. I mean, you're thinking of things completely different and it takes you away from it. And, you know, like you realize that too if you're filming something and you look up over the camera, 20 yards in the camera, depending on what lens you have, is way different than 20 yards. Yeah. Right at the bottom of your tree. So,
That's what when Maverick shot his first deer when he was six with his crossbow, I wanted Connor to film it because I wanted to be there with him. But I also knew like he might be able to pull this off because he's gotten pretty good at shooting. Yeah. And it was convenient enough that Connor, you know, came and it was a really cool moment, even though we never recovered that deer. He was emotional. He was shaking. He was crying. Sure. We got it all. Actually, no one's ever seen the footage. It's still on the hard drive somewhere.
Yeah.
Really cool video, though.
It's a really cool video.
And you and Maverick are both in the video.
We're both in the video.
You didn't film his.
Yeah. I've heard. That's the way to do
it.
And it's a really cool. I know when Maverick is older, right now, if you looked it back, he'd probably be like, "Dad, I don't want to."
Right.
Right.
When you guys are older, he's going to be like, "Oh, wow. I can't believe like that was me at six."
And man, we fought to try to like find that deer, and I sent that slow motion clip to everybody I know, and they're like, looks like it was a pretty good shot, but it was pretty high, and we knew it was high, but we were also just thinking maybe but that deer dropped down low and jumped the string. He really did jump the string. We kind of played
that's crazy. And
anyway, long story short, early hunting memory, first time Maverick pulled the trigger on anything with that crossbow when he was six, and he'd only been six for a month because he turned six September 14th and it was right around Halloween. So
there you go.
I was really stoked for him, even though we never found the deer. But
yeah. Yeah. I know that my dad talks about like when I was young and playing ball games or whatever, he doesn't like remember them at all because he was looking through, you know, some video camera.
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, that footage, it was in some weird format and, like, burned up in a house fire or whatever.
Dang it.
It's like, well, what good was it, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think that, and I know there's lots of times when I'm out hunting that I'll see something cool and I don't even try to turn the camera on because I know by the time I get it on, it's over.
Yeah.
So you just, you know, you keep some of those memories just for yourself.
I have this poster of Michael Jordan, like, shooting a game-winning three-pointer in a playoff game in the 90s, and you look and there's Jordan and he's shooting, and then you've got the whole no one's got their phone up, right, because it's like 1995. And I looked at that several times and I'm like, man, what a time to be in a moment. Right now I go to a concert and it's everything I can do to keep my phone in my pocket because I'm like, oh, I want to film. Like, I can see
so that I'll never watch this.
I can see tons of crappy cell phone footage of this concert on YouTube.
Yeah.
But for some reason, I keep wanting to reach in my pocket, like just be in it. And me and my wife went to one of my favorite bands, Third Eye Blind. Wearing a t-shirt.
Oh, how about that?
This summer. And I was really intentional about like, keep my phone in my pocket, be in the moment, enjoy it. And so we really have to think about that in our current culture, whether it's hunting or a show or whatever it is like we can overly film. Most of us have 40,000 things on our phone that we're never going to look at.
Oh, yeah.
Like, well, we're just continuing to add to a very overwhelming and unapproachable collection of content that we're never going to be able to actually curate.
Absolutely. Yeah, I try and keep all of my favorite pictures in like one album. So I'll just go back and look at that because, you know, which one cool thing like with Google Photos is they'll bring up pictures from like years past. And, you know, sometimes it's like, oh, there's a picture of that arrow that I never recovered the deer from. Thanks a lot, Google Photos.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's really cool because you can think about like, your past seasons and stuff and just look at that and see how things are different in all of those ways for sure. Yeah. So Connor, what's on the slate this year? What do you got going on? You staying in Missouri? You doing a lot of filming? What are you doing?
Work Sling Glass work wise, we're doing, we've got some stuff ramping up here in the spring. Everybody, we're not seasonal work, but in the fall, people like to do videos, and in the spring, it feels like people like to do videos. So,
yeah, absolutely.
We've got some stuff coming up here with Sling Glass. As far as turkey season, I'll be in Nebraska at the end of March for archery season. And then after that, we're going to hunt every weekend till probably the end of Missouri season, I would say, just with youth seasons and all that.
Nice. Have you done that Nebraska hunt before, or is this your first?
Yeah, I have, and I've filmed it a few times. My buddies always go out there and do that. But it's fun. It's different. Birds are normally in big flocks, and it's archery season, so that adds a whole nother level to it.
Certainly.
It's the best way we can – I like getting out early, going out there. You kind of beat the rush of the – of all the May Merriam hunters or whatever. So instead of going south, we just go over there and get a good start there. We'll be plenty busy here. And then going into deer season, we don't know on that yet. Who knows?
Yeah.
We'll end up somewhere doing something. And I might end up out west filming. One of my buddies should draw a pretty good elk tag this year. So
ooh.
I might go do that. That'll depend on how that goes.
So yeah.
If he's going to backpack for 7 days, I'm not going to film it.
What?
We don't really have that much hunting-related business anymore.
At Sling Glass, we don't do a ton of hunting stuff anymore. We've really gone more like Midwest brand, and we like to say blue-collar work with a bunch
okay,
of,
sure.
Agriculture.
Ag brands, yeah.
We've got a racing documentary series we've been working on small-town racing.
That's exciting.
That's going to be really cool.
Yeah.
The hunting thing has been... It's fun and it's great, but to be transparent, to pay a team of people, you've got to find industries that have, you know, working capital.
The
hunting industry is not always that way, but we have some core relationships that will never go away. Mossy Oak is one of those that, always working on fun stuff with them. We've got a couple projects in the hopper with them that we'll, you know, hopefully always be doing because that relationship goes beyond financial, you know?
Sure.
It's just like a really, really important relationship to us and to them too.
Yeah. So. And it goes beyond hunting videos.
True.
Like, we do content for Mossy Oak, but we're not filming hunting videos for them. We're doing lifestyle stuff and just branding stuff and general stuff like that, which is storytelling, which is the roots of Slate and Glass, and you can do that with anything. So it's
fun. Yeah, absolutely. Yep. There's a story in everything. You guys do a great job with all your stuff too that I've ever seen. It's all extremely professional and very succinct too. Not a lot of rambling forever. Like, I don't know. That's one thing that drives me nuts when I'm watching, you know, story heavy videos. It's like, hey, I heard that 8 times already, but
you guys
are always good about that.
Our whole thing is really figuring out how to, I never like to pick up the pace of something to make it too fast and too quick. I want someone to really be able to soak in a story, but I also don't want to bore them. So it's like finding that balance between how do we move in a positive direction with the pace and the tempo, but also keep it pared back so people can really soak in whatever that story is.
Yeah.
So that's the constant thing. And it's pretty... Oh, I will give a shout out to our Prairie Prophets show that I'm looking forward to season 2 coming out because it's all about alternative energy and agricultural practices. But the big story is about American agriculture and wildlife habitat, which is to me exciting. So,
yeah, that sounds super interesting. I gotta dive into that because I've definitely gotten a lot more into the idea of prairies and restoration and stuff. And, you know, it's just, it's the way of the future, right? Is to learn about the past, kind of.
Yeah. And anybody who's got questions right now about habitat and what wildlife needs to thrive and survive can learn a lot from looking back at the lens of where, I mean, wildlife survived and thrived best in an environment that God created himself.
Yeah.
And so how do we try to replicate what, not that we can replicate excuse me, not that we can replicate the creator, but how do we figure out how to start to restore things in a way that looks more like it did?
Yeah.
In its original form. So.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I liked what you said about putting things at a pace where people can soak it in and not rushing it too much. I think that's a great way to think about this upcoming turkey season. You know, you want to put it at a pace that you can really soak it all in. So you're not going to bore yourself to death or beat your head against the wall, but you're also not going to rush through it, right? Because at the end of the year, you know, whether you have one more fan on your wall or not, it's going to be those memories, right, that stick with you. And, you know, maybe you don't push it that first day, maybe not that first week. Maybe you soak it in. And Missouri has a pretty good built-in way of keeping you from doing too much too soon. They're like, listen, if you kill one bird, you got to leave for a week.
or help your buddies.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's a pretty good built-in way to do it. But I think that it's something we can all look at this year and make sure that we're, you know, because the amount of time I spend wishing it was turkey season versus the amount of time I spend enjoying the rough parts of turkey season, it doesn't really compute. Like, I need to make that equation make more sense, right?
Yeah.
Make sure to appreciate it plenty while it's here. So I think we'll wrap it up right there. Thank you guys so much for being on the podcast. I really appreciate that. And thank you to everybody listening at home. If you can leave me a 5-star review, that helps out a lot, or recommend me to a friend or enemy, doesn't matter. A recommendation is a recommendation. I'll take it any way I can get it. You can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok at How to Hunt Turkey. And you can email me at howtohuntturkey@gmail.com. But anyways, thank you guys so much for listening, and take somebody hunting with you.
Ready to relax in your dream bath retreat without the stress of figuring out every detail yourself? At the Home Depot, your bath upgrade is covered. Shop fully designed rooms and curated bath collections to go from inspiration to transformation fast. Savings of up to 40% will make it easier on your budget. And find everything you need, from tubs to toilets and all the tile in between, to bring your vision to life. The Home Depot. Dream baths built here.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.